You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 155 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the two first-round pick having in the 2019 NFL Draft Seattle Seahawks.
There we go.
Which may not be true by the time you listen to this podcast. Who knows? They may have already traded down by then. Hopefully you'll listen to it Thursday ahead of the draft.
Episode 155. Speaking of two first-round picks, this is the Frank...
Not the Frank Clark episode. Instead, it's the Steve Scheffler episode of the Pelton Cast.
Hello.
Got to pay tribute to the all-time greatest 55 in Seattle sports.
There we go.
In our hearts.
Chef.
We've got some toasts this week. So let's get into...
Boy, do we have some toasts.
...this week's beer, which is the Fremont Paradise Peak Pilsner. I think we did have this previously on the podcast as I read this. A crisp pilsner to welcome the coming sun and warm days, which it was a pretty warm day today. We first brewed this beer to drink after working a shift at the brewery and kept brewing it because, well, we work a lot of shifts and need a lot of beer. And we thought this pilsner was really good, and we brewed some to share with you. Paradise Peak is brewed with German and Pacific Northwest malts and Yakima Valley hops.
All right, here's, you're going to hear three pshs here.
You're opening the side beer right now?
There we go. I am doing, this is a two beer toast. You ready for it? I'm toasting with the cans instead of the glass.
Yeah.
I have two beers in my hand right now. Do you want to know what one is for?
What's that?
One is for the city of Seattle.
And one is for the city of Portland.
And the other is for the city of Portland.
All right, we start, of course.
There we go.
A toast to the Trailblazers. Advancing to the Western Conference semifinals with Tuesday night's 118-115 thrilling victory over the Oklahoma City Thunder to win the series 4-1. Okay, we got to continue toasting. First up here, to Damian Lillard.
Oh! Who hit, we're going to talk more about this.
One of the most unbelievable.
I'm using my Portland beer to toast.
Game-winning shots in NBA history to give him an even 50 points for the night. Like, that is poetic.
Mwah. Everything about it was so good. We're going to talk a lot more about this.
A toast to Enes Kanter.
I'm using my Seattle beer for that one. Huh. But despite the Oklahoma City Thunder, said you can't play him.
Can play him. We knew that he was like, he had to be, you know, angrier about that than he was letting on after game one when, I don't think I asked him that question, but, I was writing about Kanter after game one and then also ended up writing about him.
He was sitting on that tweet.
He was sitting on that tweet
for a long time.
Mina tweeted today that he was sitting on it since game one, and someone pointed out in the mentions, which is 100% accurate, he's been sitting on it since that quote was uttered by Billy Donovan. Okay, next up, to Yusuf Nurkic.
Mm.
Got to go Portland beer here.
Portland beer for sure for Nurk.
Nurk, the real low-key MVP of the game, has not been to any Blazers games since his horrific injury. That once upon a time, people thought, perhaps myself included, thought ended the Blazers' chances of doing anything in the playoffs. Decides in the third quarter to get dressed, take some painkillers, and get in the car and head down to the Moda Center.
Did he drive himself? I want to be there for the process of this happening.
Someone has to drive him. I don't think he's in condition to drive at this stage, this soon after the injury.
This is the Steve Scheffler episode, the Sonics human victory cigar. Yusuf Nurkic showing up and being the literal victory cigar for the Blazers, guiding them to victory.
I don't know if that's how that expression works. They didn't like win by a bunch and then celebrate. So the Blazers are down 8 when he shows up on the bench, by all counts. They finish the game on a 14-3 run because they ended up winning by 3. So they were plus 11 as Terry Stotts did that. He did some Pelton Cast math on the podium during his press conference last night.
I think
Pelton
Cast math is supposed to be wrong.
Well, he originally said 8 and then corrected it to 11.
Okay, so he was me when he said 8 and he was you when he corrected it to 11.
Fun fact, he didn't hear it, but I did correct it.
Of course you did. you're there where everybody, wherever there's a person doing bad math, you're there to correct them.
Nurkic, like, immensely popular in Portland. until Damian Lillard's game-winning shot, the loudest cheer of the night, I swear, was for Jusuf Nurkić being shown on the arena.
I could feel it here on the TV in Seattle that Nurk was in the building.
You could just feel it when he showed up. and another interesting thing, there's a billboard for Jusuf Nurkić along one of kind of the main thoroughfares when Broadway splits off there just by the arena that I happened to see that I hadn't seen anything about previously.
Okay.
All right, next up to CJ McCollum.
Oh, CJ.
Great series. And also kind of an amazing outcome for him. Injured late, middle of March. Unclear whether he's going to be able to get back in time for the playoffs or be effective in it. And lo and behold,
he's back, baby. Huge series for CJ.
Maurice Harkless.
Mo.
Huge. Throughout this series, so many blocks of Paul George. And then a huge fourth quarter for the Blazers when they needed production, trailing by 15 at one point. Harkless tied for the leading scorer in the fourth with 10 points. Al-Farouq Aminu.
Okay, you're adding in chief.
Didn't have a huge game five, but did have an enormous game four in Oklahoma City to help Portland take a 3-1 lead in this series.
I feel like we have to kind of get the chief toast in. One of the most disorienting things that has to happen for my family while they're not watching Blazers games is me just randomly out of nowhere yelling chief really loud.
And then lastly, get your Seattle beer ready.
Going back
to
the Seattle beer. This is not lastly. I've got more to add here.
Oh, you've got more? Okay. This was last on my list. Terry Stotts coached a great series. Very nearly lost his job after the Blazers got swept last year by the New Orleans Pelicans in the first round. I asked him a question in the pregame about that series because it had come up in the previous question. He was like, yeah, I don't want to talk about that series
You're really bumming Terry Stotts out here. Well-actualing him. You're bringing up bad memories.
He was in a jovial mood than when I asked a second question during that press conference, though. So
when he
called
said
that out.
You again, was that like contentious?
No.
Okay.
No.
Does he know who you are?
Yes.
Okay. Former Sonics assistant, right?
Yeah.
Getting the win against Oklahoma City, and that's why I had the one last toast. It's to the greatest broadcaster in NBA history.
Yeah.
Being able to call this game, to call that shot, Kevin Calabro, after the game, like, it was so incredible to see. Like, I think for us, capping everything off, there was Calabro on the sideline with Lamar Hurd next to him.
With Lamar Hurd just on the sideline for hours after the game, apparently. I didn't go back into the bowl to see it, but per his Twitter post.
But Kevin Calabro was there celebrating this moment, like tearing up while it was happening. It was like, this shit matters to Kevin Calabro, right?
Throwing in a sly Dave Niehaus reference in there.
Did he?
Yeah, he said, fly, fly away.
I mean, there's nobody who, if you questioned whether it was okay to cheer for the Blazers in that moment, just know that Kevin Calabro was calling that game, right?
I mean, both Blazers broadcasters were members of the Sonics broadcast crew and have Seattle ties because Brian Wheeler is their radio broadcaster.
Okay. I was like, where's this going with Lamar Hurd?
Oh, no, yeah.
What sort of alternate history are you talking about?
He actually played at UW, not Oregon State. Fun fact.
But seeing Kevin Calabro be able to have that moment, having him call it, right, on the only broadcast that we recognize, right, the only game-winning call that we recognize around here. The broadcast that got that clip of Dame poking his head out looking serious, right?
It's so amazing. Oh, Dame.
That was not a clip that TNT got. That was right here on Comcast Sportsnet with Kevin Calabro. But for him, seeing Kevin Calabro be like
NBC Sports Northwest now,
whatever. But Kevin Calabro being choked up about that, I was like, wow, this was a thing that happened.
It sure was a thing that happened.
Let's talk about the Blazers. We'll do our poor one out later.
Yes.
Okay. I want to yada, yada, yada the entire game. until
you want to yada, yada over Damian Lillard scoring 34 points in the first half?
Great performance. Take me
the most points and a half in 14 years in an NBA playoff game.
Take me to, like, 5 minutes left.
Well, let's go to when the Thunder go up 15.
That's what I want to talk about.
That was, I think, like 7:20 left.
Okay, 7:20. In that moment, And I've talked about this. The best games that you can ever watch, the reason that this felt so redemptive was because we saw the darkness.
Yeah, I saw the chat. I saw the darkness from you, that's for sure.
And this is what sports is all about. Sometimes you have to see the darkness to really feel the light.
I think the Thunder had gone on a 30-6 run to take the... They were down by 9, was the Blazers' biggest lead late in the third quarter, then go up by 15. And it really felt like, you know, like in a video game where you're playing like a boss, mm-hmm. and you kind of think you've got it won, and then all of a sudden they go into this like crazy frenetic mode, mm-hmm. and it gets exponentially more difficult.
Yes.
That's what the Thunder were during that stretch. It was like they're flying around defensively. There's so much length, so much athleticism, so much size. And it's like, oh, hey, there's a reason this is a really scary team, despite the fact that they have no outside shooting whatsoever. And that was that stretch. And then you're facing the prospect of having to go play them again in Oklahoma City.
That to me is, we saw the darkness. I think the Blazers really saw the darkness. And that darkness was having to get on a plane and fly to fucking Oklahoma.
I mean,
here's my theory.
I mean, it could have been anywhere.
I want to give a theory about this. But no, it is still like, you're talking in a long, grueling flight to go play in Oklahoma. This is why the Warriors lost game 5 at home, is because flying back to LA after that and playing a game is not that big of a deal.
It wasn't that daunting.
Right? They're like, yes, whatever, we'll play one more game in LA. Who cares? The idea that the Blazers would have to fly all the way across the country to Oklahoma to play that team in their house, to try to give them the opportunity to talk more shit, was like the Blazers could not let that happen.
That might be some Pelton Cast geography on across the country to Oklahoma.
But this is...
It's a long flight.
I mean, it's showing the, like, ridiculousness of them being a quote-unquote Western Conference team.
I mean, there just happens to be a lot more teams in the eastern half of the United States. Anyways, but then, you know, if you lose that game, then it's a winner-take-all game 7, and that's a situation you want to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the thought I had, it was weird because, I mean, the Blazers are down 15, and you're like, ooh, this is... They're in real trouble now. But there was also like that little thought in the back of my head, like, you know, maybe the Thunder will run out of gas after this run and there's still time for the Blazers. And it wasn't a case of, you know, like a really quick run to get right back into it. It was really much more of a like chipping away at the lead slowly.
Which, I mean, a lot of help from Mo Harkless.
Yeah, I mean, CJ McCollum, who had struggled most of the game with his shooting, had 3 fouls in the first half, sat, you know, the entire second quarter. He made some big shots in that run, knocked down some difficult runners after hard closeouts. And, you know, then there was still enough plays that it still seemed unlikely. I mean, they're down 8 after Russell Westbrook making a 3 with 4:26 left. And it's like, oh, if Westbrook's going to make 3, it's like, you know, what's
like
even happening here?
Westbrook hitting a 3 is always the like, oh, God, this is happening?
it definitely is. But slowly they continue walking down the lead. 2 huge free throws by Harkless at the 1:22 mark.
Those, did you, in that moment, did you think that he was going to hit those free throws?
Probably not both of them, no. By the way, Paul George missing 2 free throws at the 2:15
mark.
This to
me, where it's like, those free throws that Paul George missed, I mean, there's the difference in the game.
After a kind of dubious call?
Ball don't lie.
Terry Stotts did not, in fact, quote cheat for the second consecutive postgame, but really, it didn't come up. There were a lot bigger things to discuss after the way the game ended. CJ ties it with 57 seconds left on a pull-up. Paul George gives the Thunder back the lead on a 15-footer with 39 seconds left. Blazers take timeout, their first of 2 remaining in the last 2 minutes. And then comes the shot that has been most overshadowed in this game. An incredible driving layup by David
Lillard. Layup. So, okay, in this moment, here's what I'm thinking, right? There's like 37 seconds left, right? I'm like, they need to score fast, or at least take a shot fast.
I mean, you want to get the 2 for 1.
You don't want to be in a situation where you have to foul. And then Dame instantly drives to the hoop, gets spun around, a play where I thought maybe he was fouled. Spun around, still hits it with the right hand off the glass. And in that moment, you're like, all right, like the game is going to be in the Blazers' hands one way or another.
Yeah. I had a really good view of that because he was kind of like dry as he reversed. He was driving back towards the side of the court that we were on. So that was cool to see. Then the final possession for the Thunder. Russell Westbrook getting into the paint, missing at the rim, something he did a lot of over the course of the series. No timeout from the Blazers in this tie game. Dame dribbles it across half court. And I got to say, my thought in the moment was, he's taking too long and going too late. And the same thing is happening that it had happened at the end of the first half of game one. And it happened at the end of the Brooklyn overtime where they trapped him and he kind of didn't move fast enough and they didn't even get a shot off at that point. And it was like, this isn't going to work out. But Dame had a plan the whole time.
Well, I mean, just like in that time is ticking down, right?
Yeah.
You're just like, you need to go, Dame. Right? You're like, it's at five. Start going. Like, that's what you're used to seeing at the end of a game in the situation. Somebody waiting until it's 5-6, driving, and then looking for that opportunity. Never do you see anything like this. And especially never do you see anything like this where it works.
Yeah. I mean, it turns out he was measuring Paul George for the shot. Steps back, creates space. Steps back to probably, it was probably 40 feet, as I tweeted, it was officially listed at 37, but that seems conservative. And it's over the outstretched arms of Paul George, probably the single best perimeter defender in the NBA. I mean, so one of the questions that popped up after this is, was that a good shot?
Well, just give it a second here.
Okay, just, well, he knocks down.
Bang! Dame with the three!
I thought we had already established that.
Is this the greatest shot that you have ever seen in person at a basketball game?
I think it has to be. I mean, so we were debating it as we walked into the media room immediately afterwards. I mean, the question is that and the Dame game winner against Houston in 2014.
Were you there in Golden State for the Kyrie three that he hit?
I was. I mean, the fact that it wasn't the very end of a game, like that was the most important shot, but you didn't know at the time that it was necessarily the game winner.
It seems more important now than it did in the moment.
Yeah. I mean, there's something...
And the degree of difficulty, it was just a three, right? It wasn't like it was right. That crazy of a shot.
There's something... And there's also something really satisfying about the fact that both of these Dame shots went in after the buzzer. And also the fact that there... This is notable. The fact that there wasn't a replay to determine whether it was... Like, that would have lost a lot of the moment if they had had to wait around to
good.
See.
Dame timed it perfectly.
But in this case... Like, and like the Kyrie shot, like the Cavs can't all stream onto the court to celebrate that shot. I assume the Warriors took time out. I don't remember anymore, but like, it's not the same thing where like everyone makes a beeline for him. I mean, that's the most satisfying.
The thing that it reminded me of the most watching that pile of players, Dame with his head up serious, was 95, Ken Griffey Jr. at the bottom of the pile.
I was just thinking. It's, right? Yeah, same
That's
thing.
Exactly what it was, which is crazy that this is the situation that we're in with the Portland team having to do this. But not only did my favorite team win, not the Thunder win, it's a complicated situation, but also the Blazers won. Everything about this was perfect. Right down to him hitting the shot over Paul George, beating the Thunder, who had the gall to they win one game in the series and talked so much shit. It's just like it, like if you had a playbook for how not to handle a series, this is it. This is how you do not handle a playoff series. The Thunder did it from top to bottom. It's just like have some decorum here where you're winning a game, right?
I mean, to me, the big thing is like. The scoreboard does the talking, eventually.
I mean, that's definitely what Dame Lillard thinks.
He did his fair share of talking.
All the way down to the best player in the series, hits a three to win the series, score his 50th point against what is supposedly one of the best perimeter defenders in basketball.
No, he legitimately is.
This moment against the team that was stolen from the city of Seattle, defending the entire Northwest's honor out there, right? Kevin Clabro on the sideline announcing in the game. Jermaine Effetti in the stands. Dwayne Brown in the stands.
George Fant in the stands.
George Fant in the goddamn stands. Dame Lillard knocking down that three. This moment was incredible.
Yeah.
There's just, that's it.
Can I talk about the shot now?
This is my favorite part, though. Okay, so you remember when I was saying that if you were to do a playbook for how to not handle a playoff series, this right here is the final paragraph of that playbook.
Paul George asked about the final shot.
So good.
His defense on it says it was a bad shot.
I don't care what anybody says. It's a bad shot.
And the thing is, he's right.
He's not right. Dame said it. If you go to the rim, the amount of contact that they would have had to have had, that they would have had to call a foul. Like, Paul George is contacting him on that play if he drives. And he would have had to have been destroyed for them to have called a foul there. And Dame's just like, I'm taking a shot. He's been hitting these. It's a bad shot for a lot of players, but Dame Lillard has been making these all series long, from the first shot to the last shot, bookending it.
It is true.
Dame Lillard has been knocking these down in the Thunder's faces, and like, sure, maybe that'd be a bad shot for you, Paul George. It's not a running floater or whatever. It's not losing and then complaining about your shoulder being hurt. It's not your point guard who can't shoot.
He didn't. I mean,
taking a jump shot. We're talking about Dame Lillard and Dame time knocking down the most important shot. There is no bad shot in that situation.
There's no bad shot in that situation.
It's a bad shot. Come on, Paul George. Like, what? Why do you even need to say that? Who are you telling that to? Yourself?
I'm probably.
He's going to be...
To get into it intellectually.
Huddled up at night while he's trying to... Before he's becoming a faceless man, reading off that was a bad shot to himself for years.
Whew. I mean, first off, if Lillard had driven in that situation, even if he doesn't get the call, I mean, that does create an opportunity for a second chance, you know, in his Cantor putback. I assume Cantor... He might not have been on the court at that point.
What are we doing here?
But, I mean, the thing is...
Dame Lillard, it's the best shot that you've ever seen in your entire life, and you're talking about what could have been?
I mean, it's partially the best shot because of the fact that it was such an incredibly difficult shot.
Can't
That's
we just
part of what makes
enjoy it so... greatness for a second?
We enjoyed greatness for a lot of seconds. But the one I do want to make one point about this, which is I don't think you can cite his making a bunch of deep threes over the course of the series as a reason it was a good shot, because A, this was longer than any of them, and B, you know the reason that he took that three in the very first possession? Because Russell Westbrook was playing back at the three-point line. There was nobody within 7 feet of him. That's the difference between this, is there was someone contesting the shot, and it was someone who was 6'9" and has incredibly long arms. So, I mean, that again, that makes it all the more impressive of a shot, but it was a bad shot. We can accept that. Like,
was it disrespectful for Sean Kemp to point it out in Lister? What are we doing here?
I don't know what.
We're just going to go back at all of the greatest moments that ever happened. We're going to try to rewrite them. Let this great moment live.
It's not living.
We don't need to talk about what could have been.
Okay.
We're talking about what was, and this was the best basketball shot you've ever seen.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
It was also just like, I mean, the environment. Like,
people. Did you cheer? What did you do when the shot went through? You just sit there stone-faced?
I don't remember in the moment exactly what my reaction was.
It would have been, because you were happy when it went in, right?
I was shocked.
Okay. It would have been so hard for me not to have reacted to that. Anyway, Dame, 40 feet, knocks it down. Bye, Thunder. See you later.
I mean, the wave was perfect. I didn't see the wave. I didn't know about that until, like, people started tweeting about it, really.
Everything was perfect. There was not a part of the setup that wasn't perfect.
Yeah.
Except for apparently the shot selection.
I mean, did you read? I just don't know why it's so upset. Like, just admit it's a bad shot. It's not that big of a deal. Why, did you read Chris Haynes' piece?
No.
On Yahoo? So Damian Lillard.
You're like, Mike, you didn't have to shoot it over Byron Russell. You could have just driven there, right? Like, you could have gotten to the hoop.
I'm not even saying necessarily he should have driven.
Byron Russell is a really good defender.
I mean, obviously the truth risk on that is that he pushed off.
Oh, yes, yes.
Come on. Give Jazz fans some respect there. It's a tough time for them. Wait, what was the question again?
I don't know. Chris Haynes?
Oh, yeah. So Damian Lillard invited him to watch the Warriors-Clippers game, or the Rockets-Jazz game the previous night with him at his home in Portland, and told Chris Haynes that we were going to send, I believe, these motherfuckers home the next day, which they did. But the quote that people slept on from that story is that he also, Chris Haynes, after game three, after all the taunting you were talking about, asked Dame whether he should come watch game four in Oklahoma City because of what the Blazers were going to have in store for the Thunder. And Dame told him, no, enjoy your Easter dinner with the family. Come see us eliminate them on Tuesday. He called the shot. Like,
Dame Stradamus. That's what you're talking about right there. There we go.
That is some confidence, man.
Oh, my God. Whew. We're still in the intro right now. We haven't even done our pour one out.
That is accurate.
The moment was perfect. Everything about it. And my favorite thing about it also was having people on my Twitter timeline, both Seattle people and national people, every single one of them talking about this moment, excited about Dame. There was no hate except for Tyler Lockett, who I don't follow. And if I were to have had followed him, I would have unfollowed him.
Yes. You said you liked 12 consecutive tweets.
20 consecutive tweets.
20?
And the reality is, I liked even more than that. It was just like, man. Every tweet that was happening about that for the rest of the night, no matter what, I was liking that tweet, because that's the mood that we were in, right?
Yeah, I mean, you just wanted that moment that night to go on forever.
It's, you know how sometimes like there like big events you have a letdown after? Never would I have thought that I would have felt that feeling about a Blazers game. But yep. Here we are.
Yep.
The whole thing was incredible. The whole series was just played out perfectly. Like, even them losing that game in hindsight, giving the Thunder a chance to do all the trash talk that they were doing, giving them a window and an opportunity for the Blazers to shut the door on them, to wave goodbye at them later. Like, that, it just all ended up so perfect. And we can only hope that they were shutting the door, not only on this season for the Thunder, but also on the entire Thunder. You're giving me a skeptical look. On the entire, regime, period, era.
I mean, era is probably the word you're looking at here.
Let's shut the door here and get them out of the playoffs next year.
Yeah. I mean, Paul George's shoulder is going to be healthy by next season. That's going to make a big difference.
I meant to right after just be like, just wait till they get Andre Roberson back.
Robertson.
Once they get Andre Robertson back, that's going to change everything.
I mean, if he were healthy, they wouldn't have had to play Raymond Felton so much. So I think it would have helped.
No, I saw no Raymond Felton in that game.
He only played like 3 minutes, but that's because they had to play Westbrook and George 44 minutes. And maybe that had something to do with the fact that they got tired at the end.
Is Andre Robertson playing instead of Raymond Felton? No. They have like four Andre Robertsons on that team. It's a team made entirely of Andre Robertsons. What is the like? I guess maybe Andre Robertson's longer.
What if we made the whole plane out of Andre Robertson?
That's what most of the pundits would have you believe.
Andre Robertson's a very good defender. Look,
the difference between Jeremy Grant, Terrence Ferguson, and Andre Robertson.
Can I tell you to learn something
great.
From the Thunder?
What? We've got a long time. Nope. You're not telling me not to take a victory lap here because their season is over.
But don't celebrate things before they happen.
Andre Robertson may come back this season.
If you're talking about the Thunder's era, it is not over.
Okay. So anyway, we pour one out. how long were you at the arena? Like, what was...
I got back to my hotel about 1:30.
Okay.
So like... Yeah.
You were at the arena for a long time after.
A long time. I mean, the Breakside beer that they have on tap for media members post game was flowing.
Oh, it was flowing. God damn, that sounds great.
I mean, people stayed so much longer than they ever normally would. That's the one thing I don't really remember happening after game six in 2014, the Houston game.
Was that also, or no, this was just a weeknight, right?
Yeah. That was on a Friday night, actually.
Huh.
Everyone was like so caught up in the moment. So, I mean, you know, all the screens had either it was ESPN or the NBC sports feed and they just keep replaying the game and the shot and everyone wanted to watch it every time. It was quite a moment.
So good.
Yeah.
We'll talk more about next week. I mean, the series will already be started by the time, we next talk, but we'll be talking more about the Blazers later
on. Game one versus either Denver or San Antonio would be at Denver or home in Portland if it's the Spurs who pull out this series in seven games. Will be Monday night.
All right.
Can't wait.
Well, I mean, this whole thing was perfect. There's just like everything about it was perfect. So excited that this happened.
So now it's time to pour one out.
All right.
Thankfully, we still have some beer left.
I don't know. We're not toasting. We're pouring one out.
For Marshawn Lynch. The legendary
Portland beer
running back who does not plan to play football again, according to ESPN's Adam Schefter. Haven't had that confirmed by Marshawn himself, but would not be terribly surprising if he decided to hang them back up a second time on the power line, right? That was the thing when he retired. I mean, one of my takeaways here, by the way, is that like Marshawn was so much more effective last season than ever could have imagined at this stage of his career.
For the last 2 years. His Oakland tenure was so far from embarrassing.
Yep.
I mean, your expectation for these seasons, if I would have given you over-under on like yards per carry at like 3.5, you might have taken the under.
Yeah. I definitely would have taken the under on 4 in last season, a solid 4.2 yards per carry, 4.3 in 2017. I guess he was better than I realized in 17. Maybe I actually reversed my memory of those 2 years.
I mean, definitely dealt with some injuries, but like there was nothing embarrassing at all about this comeback for Marshawn Lynch, which when this happens for running backs like this, the chances of embarrassment are extraordinarily high. Not embarrassment even, but just like ineffectiveness.
It wasn't Sean Alexander on the Washington professional football team. That's for sure.
Well, and he didn't even take a year off. It was like this comeback from Marshawn went as perfectly as it could have gone, and he just only increased the legend of Marshawn Lynch, right? Yep. Like so. Nothing about it. And really, like, I mean, at the time, we were just like, go play for the Raiders, beast.
Yeah.
You know, there was nothing about it. This was not Richard Sherman coming back and like trying to like get in the heads of the Seahawks or whatever. This was Marshawn Lynch going and playing for his hometown team, still being a Seattle legend, and us loving every second of it.
He'll always belong to both Seattle and Oakland, much like Damian Lillard.
So good. I mean, he's got the whole West Coast on lock. He's wherever you can buy Winmer Hefeweizen, Damian Lillard is there.
Okay, that's an interesting choice for that. I was actually going through Mama Lynch's timeline because she kind of seemed to maybe throw some water on the idea that Marshawn is actually retiring, but I'm not sure if she was or not. And she was tweeting about Dame from last night.
There we go.
She was as excited as everyone else. She was there like in 20 consecutive tweets. Should we talk about Seattle sandwiches?
Wow, we haven't talked about sandwiches yet.
Oh, no, we haven't gotten to do that. We're back.
I wanted to do a reaction pod to, like, everything this week. Like, last night I was so upset that we couldn't do a podcast right after.
Yeah, unfortunately I had to do my job and
If you would have been here in Seattle, are we doing an emergency pod about it?
If that was... Oh.
If you weren't at the game. If we were just watching the game.
Yeah. Yeah, we probably would.
All right. Okay. Just tell me, just tell me it was emergency pod worthy. Yeah. We would have been two in a day. Emergency podcast.
I don't know if we've done that before.
All emergency pods.
We combined the Robinson Cano and Coach Pete into a single podcast.
Well, this happened at the same time.
Yeah. All right. Our search for Seattle's best sandwich last weekend took us to Sisters and Brothers, which was opened in Georgetown in March 2016 with restaurateur and Bainbridge native Jake Manny bringing Nashville's signature hot chicken to Seattle after spending 5 years there working in the restaurant bar industry. And open to rave reviews. So I don't think there may have been some hot chicken.
To rave reviews?
Yeah, I think so.
Their Yelp is shockingly bad.
Partially because the hype was so big when they first started. I think that like expectations were set too high.
Have I given you my theory about their Yelp?
What's that?
My theory is...
Oh, white people don't like spice?
Yeah, I mean, this is like... we'll talk more about this in a second.
They don't know what they're getting into.
This is real hot chicken. This is not like... the spicy at Azell's, which you can't even literally taste spice on sometimes. This is hot chicken.
Shouts to Azell's on their 35th anniversary, by the way, this year.
All right. Toast to them, too.
Seattle.
this is, if you are used to like what I would consider Seattle hot, which I think is one of their designations for the mild.
Is it?
I'm pretty sure that's what they call...
Gonna rethink that order.
If this is that, then you're gonna be shocked when you taste real spice.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of people went there not knowing what they were really getting themselves into, over-ordered.
Yeah.
Right? They went too spicy. People couldn't handle it. That's why you have bad Yelp reviews. Because it couldn't be about the chicken or the chicken sandwiches.
And also because Yelp sucks. That's a good take, though.
thank you.
So this is, I would say, one of my neighborhood sandwiches. So it's a place I've frequented over the years, gone to regularly, as you have as well, I think.
Yeah, I've been there a lot of times.
Okay. It's a cool vibe. It's kind of a hipster bar. There's like video games. You know, it's a good place to hang out. Not that I've done so outside of eating there. Anyways,
you can't really hang out there without eating there. It's not a. I mean, you could maybe sit at the bar, but.
So it actually worked out. The reason we ended up going to Sisters and Brothers last weekend to take the listener behind the process here.
Oh, mild is Seattle hot. Yeah, that's what I said.
You had it right.
So okay, here are the spice levels. If you're curious, naked, which is a little bit.
No, yeah.
Mild, which is Seattle hot. Hot, which is Nashville hot. Insane, which doesn't even have a description. It's just insane.
That's insane anywhere. So we actually were going to try to go to Georgetown Deli and Market on Saturday because you were in the area. And lo and behold, they were closed randomly on Saturday. Did we ever get email canceling that?
No,
order?
We need to
place online.
We might need to follow up on that.
Yeah, we may have to do that.
You may need to contact your credit card company.
Very much, but so instead, you got takeout since they were not open. You instead got takeout from Sisters and Brothers, which is right nearby there. It's not the ideal, probably, setting to try Sisters and Brothers. It's not designed to travel well for takeout, even though they now do it.
Oh, I thought the presentation was pretty good.
The presentation was very good. I'm just saying, like, my expectations were tempered a little bit when I started eating the sandwich. And then you know what happened? Those expectations were blown away!
Wow!
This last time...
I was physically blown away.
You were. This last time, I feel, was the single best hot chicken I've had at Sisters and Brothers.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, you would assume that this is my other issue with Yelp is a lot of people go to places right when they open and like they're not hitting their stride right when they start, right? If you listen to this first Pelton cast, they're not great.
Oh, they are terrible.
They're nowhere near the excellent quality that they're at now.
Let's go with adequate.
It's a bad shot. I don't care what anybody
I just
says.
I don't know why you're so upset about it. Shot went in.
Yeah. So it would make sense that they're always improving.
But it's been a while probably since I've been there. It might have been last summer was the last time I went. But it's not like it was like right after they opened. That was like 2 years after they opened. So I was surprised and pleasantly so. Like I think the breading was slightly better. You got two enormous strips of chicken.
A lot
of
chicken, yes.
And then the bun I thought was really good.
Yeah, the whole situation was great.
I gotta say, I mean, like, as I'm eating it, I'm like, this might be up there with Mo'ono.
Oh, man.
Did you feel that way?
So I got the hot. Right.
And I naturally got the mild, the Seattle hot. And one of the things I liked about it, one of the theories I had is that maybe it wasn't quite as hot as it had been before. And that was part of what made the experience more enjoyable.
You think they've mildened it down? Because I remember having the mild back in the day, and it was still pretty hot.
It was still very hot, yes. I mean, not that this was like nothing, but
maybe they've taken the whole thing down a bit.
Could be.
Or the hot was still pretty damn hot, though.
But that was the first time you've gone with the hot, right?
Yeah, I've always gone with the mild in the past. But you know what I said to myself? You only live one life, right? Well, I'm going to get this Nashville hot chicken. Sure, I might suffer for a little while. My mouth might be hot. I might feel it in my stomach. I might feel it in my bowels after that. I might be thinking about it or burp it up like 2 hours later and have it be one of the hottest things that I've ever tasted.
You almost drove off the road at some point.
Sure, I might die from driving off the road because of that. But I got the hot.
And you survived it.
You understand what I'm saying? I'm here right now talking about
sure.
it. And I got the hot and you didn't.
Congrats.
So I felt like, I don't need to do the insane. You know what I mean? Like that just wouldn't be an intelligent
situation. That's actually only there for Danny Chow when and if he comes to Seattle.
But just doing the Nashville level hot, I'm like, okay, I can handle this. Like it wasn't bad. And the thing was, it actually tasted really good.
Yeah, I mean, if I had one like knock on this, there was times when you're getting into kind of the fleshier part of the meat where it wasn't particularly flavorful.
Huh. See, I didn't get that at all. Because your mouth is coated with a lot of
food. Yeah.
There was no not flavorful. Because
is that capucin? What's in there?
It's not just hot, though. Like, well, it is just hot. It's that it's hot and good.
Yes.
Right? That's the thing that I think is really important. Because there's a difference between hot for hot's sake. But this was like, wow, this is very hot in my mouth. But I'm like really enjoying the flavors that I'm tasting.
Okay.
You know, like... To me, the only issue was that we didn't enjoy this over like 3 Rainier Tall Boy cans because that's how it's meant to be consumed.
Okay, see, that's the part of the presentation too.
And it's like, if you're, and sometimes you're like, I need that Rainier Tall Boy right now. It has to be really cold and I need it right this second. Because you got to just sometimes get the heat out. But otherwise, I feel like flavor-wise, the whole package was really up there.
So when you get the sandwich at Sisters and Brothers, it also comes with a side. We both did mac and cheese, which is, it's solid. It's not spectacular, but it's solid.
Yeah. But we're not judging the best mac and cheese in Seattle.
I just wanted to throw that out there so people knew before they went.
Well, no, it's a $15 sandwich, right? Which is a little steep.
Yes.
But it includes the side. And so that makes it a little bit better. You feel like you're basically paying like $10 for the sandwich, $5 for the side.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I don't know if I can quite get to as good as Maono.
I mean, it ultimately did not get that far. But I'm saying it's like, it's in the conversation here.
It's definitely in the conversation. It's just a different thing.
Yeah.
The difference to me between the two, though, it's those pickles at Maono, which you don't even eat, right?
I don't know.
The pickles are just a freaking game changer at Maono. I think the chicken, when you look at it, kind of chicken to chicken, they're very different flavor profiles, but I think it's so high quality. The thing that it really did was made me reassess Bacabac, and I'm just like, Bacabac's just not there.
I got to say, I had the same thought. So I had to go in between those two with my rating.
I don't even remember what I gave Maono. I think I gave it a 98.
Sounds about right.
I'm giving Sisters and Brothers a 93.
I give it a 92. So we're in the same ballpark here.
It was great. I'm so excited to go back there. But also, like, oh man, I was gonna say it's not a better atmosphere than Maono. I don't know. They're both such good atmospheres. Right? Sisters and Brothers
Well, you know, we'll see what happens. We've still got a few others in the chicken sandwich category. But I think it's very possible that these two could be facing off in the chicken sandwich final.
Well, Sisters and Brothers is like a dive bar type vibe, right?
Yes.
It's like a Rainier Tallboy bar.
And it's in it's a Georgetown vibe.
Yeah. And we're talking like, this is not bougie Georgetown. We're talking, this is right next to the airport.
Yes, it is.
This is, if Georgetown isn't cool anymore, right? This is the coolest that Georgetown could be.
Okay.
Maono is a completely different experience. It's like you're ordering $10 cocktails. It's cool, but it's cool in a different way.
Yes.
So both are great. The Sisters and Brothers is like, you could go there anytime, like a Saturday night dusk, 8 p.m., hearing the planes flying over. Great.
You do a lot of things at dusk?
It's a perfect dusk bar. Maono is an excellent, like, September, like 80 degrees September day, you're going and having like a frosty ginger beer drink and a Maono sandwich. It's a perfect situation.
Okay, you've really given the listener, you know, you've crafted some.
You've got two times to go to these places.
Audience for them.
September or dusk.
That one broke me. I don't know why that one broke me. Should we talk about Seattle sports? We start with some unfortunate news on the new arena front, where the arena construction of the new arena at Seattle Center has, quote, slipped a bit, according to Todd Leiwicki.
Speaking of bad shot selection.
Leaving them behind schedule, and the opening of the arena, once expected in spring 2021, now is tentatively set for June 2021. So why is this important? Most notably for the Seattle Storm, because the WNBA season typically begins in mid to late May. So in the best case scenario, the Storm will have to start the season on the road with, you know, a few games there before playing their first game at home. If there are any further delays, and, you know, it's still tentative, the June 2021 date, then the Storm could have to split their 2021 schedule between multiple buildings after being displaced in both 2019 and 2020. And that will also matter to Oakview. Based on the lease negotiated ahead of that deal with the Oakview Group, the city of Seattle must pay the Storm $260,000 per game for any displaced game. Oakview would be responsible for those payments.
And are they willing to make those payments?
Yeah, they have agreed to that.
Okay.
The cost of the arena has also gone up yet again to between $900 and $930 million. You'll recall that I told you on the Pelton cast last fall that I talked to a source in the NBA with, you know, familiarity with the arena building process, who estimated that it would eventually cost over $1 billion for this new arena to be built. Which is, by the way, very amusing that the study that was referenced in kind of, you know, the alternatives to building the Soto Arena, I think initially suggested it was somewhere in the $260, $280 million range that they could renovate the arena into a NBA,
NHL ready facility. This was made by the Oakview Group?
No, this was the city. This, it had nothing to do with the Oakview Group.
Just, okay.
But it was a laughable, preposterous figure at the time and has become even more laughable and preposterous.
Well, there are 80 times that number. No, they're 20% of that number.
What?
What they estimated was 20% of what it will actually cost.
Something like that.
That's podcast math.
That is some definite podcast math. I mean, the one question to pose here is, why does the cost of the arena matter? And I mean, I think the important thing here is the more money Oakview spends building the arena.
Is this just their money, though? Or
it is just their money.
Who's responsible for cost overruns on the
project? They are responsible for
100%.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, there might be some things that like are related to city-related issues.
So none of this affects the city whatsoever, you're telling me?
It doesn't affect the city's bottom line. But what does affect is the more money Oakview spends building the arena, the more money they're going to have to get out of it in operating the arena. And so this is, I mean, first off, probably a concern in terms of the ticket price you're going to pay as an NHL Seattle season ticket holder or ticket holder.
It was going to be a lot no matter what.
It was, but it might even be even more. But the other thing is, for Oakview, concerts that they can bring into the arena, since their partnership with Live Nation, are going to be more profitable than sporty events. And that makes you wonder how they're going to prioritize those two things, particularly as it comes to potentially getting an NBA team down the road. Around the same time as this, earlier this week, Chris Daniels of King 5 reported that is part of the NHL Seattle series called Science of Sports and Entertainment that they're doing in conjunction with the Pacific Science Center. Oakview's VP of Events, Don Graham, said that concerts will be, quote, an anchor tenant at the new arena with 70.
Billie Eilish is an anchor tenant now.
Per year.
So they've already got... that mean? Concerts are an anchor tenant?
I mean,
it's just such a, it's a one-off thing. You come and you go. A concert cannot be an anchor tenant.
But I think what that means is...
what they're saying is if you like basketball, you better get used to cheering for the Blazers. That's what they're saying.
I mean,
did you like that Dame Lillard shot? Because you're going to see a lot more of that, because there's not going to be basketball in Seattle. 10 nights of Lil Nas X.
The issue here is how it fits in with the potential of NBA, NHL schedules.
I already told you the answer to that.
And it can be
what
done.
They're saying is they don't care about basketball. When they're saying that concerts are an arena or an anchor tenant, they're saying that the anchor tenants are hockey and concerts. Basketball is not one.
So I went and looked up at Madison Square Garden's calendar just for comparison's sake, which they no longer...
super comparable market. Anyway, let's hear Madison Square Garden.
We're just talking at the logistics of hosting 70 to 80 concerts a year. Okay. Why is this so difficult for you to understand?
Tell me what Madison Square Garden's concert.
So they have 46 concerts currently listed on their schedule, which goes out. The latest is January of 2020. So it's a 9-month period, but obviously there probably will be more additions to that. So it is feasible, although Madison Square Garden, they did eventually decide to send the Liberty to play at the up in Westchester because of the fact that they were taking two valuable dates during the summer, and the Storm will continue to play in the new arena in Seattle Center given their lease. So that's not an option. So.
Okay. I'm letting you talk. My issue here is with the verbiage. The fact that they use the term anchor tenant.
Yeah, because they're using, yes, that is because of the fact that they are, concerts are, that's where they're going to make their money. We all know that.
We've talked about this all along. Why is any of this surprising? Why are we even talking about this arena anymore? It doesn't matter.
Because it does matter. It certainly matters to the question of whether the city council approves a Soto street vacation.
Do you think that they're more likely to approve a Soto street vacation because of anything with regard to this?
I think facts ultimately matter.
Okay. It's about the approach that they're going into the situation with. If they have 30 concerts that are profitable, they'll still do those 30 concerts that are profitable instead of bringing in basketball. Because you're talking about giving up profits from everything else, cutting somebody else into the deal.
Yeah, but the question is, why can't you do both? That's the question that people would ask.
Because they don't want to. This is not about the facts of what is going to happen. This is about setting expectations right now. How do you not see that? They're setting the expectation that they're going to have 70 to 80 concerts per year, whether they will or not, because they're trying to be like the anchor tenants are hockey and concerts. That's what they're doing. That's what's happening right here. It has nothing to do with facts.
They don't need to do that. First off, okay, the arena is already being built. They don't have to convince anyone at this point.
They need to ward off the people who want basketball.
The concern is the 70 to 80 concerts.
You would be concerned if they did have that many concerts.
Yes, because that
you're
would
not
make
concerned
it difficult
at all with the mentality that you're going in with the approach to have that.
They're going in with that mentality no matter what.
Okay.
We did know. But a specific target of 70 to 80 concerts per year, we did not know that.
That, to me, is the disconcerting thing.
You're thinking about this too much from the music standpoint. And you need to think about it from the calendar standpoint.
What do you mean from the calendar standpoint?
Like how you find enough dates in the schedule if you have to reserve dates in the spring for both NBA and NHL playoff games.
And the Who.
Yes.
Yeah, it's an issue.
That's the issue towards not having an NBA team, not whether it's an anchor tenant or not.
Why would they use that term, anchor tenant?
Because...
explain to me the logic behind saying that.
Because if you're having 70 to 80 concerts per year, that's twice as many dates as you're having for the NBA or the NHL in the regular season. That's the point.
Okay.
It's the number. The numbers is what's important here.
So what should I take away from this then?
I mean, we agree that it's disconcerting in terms of their chances of bringing the NBA here.
Okay, so let me just ask you a question here. If you're somebody who wants basketball, is them forcing the issue of concerts now?
I don't understand what forcing the issue means.
Or like presenting the perspective of having a high volume of concerts, right? That's what I'm saying. If you're going in having twice as many concerts as you would hockey games or basketball games, if that's the mentality that we're going in with, is it honestly good for somebody who would want basically a two-state solution? That if you're the city council and you're like, okay, it's clear that the Key Arena is going to be used for hockey and concerts. Because right now what we're hearing and what we will know is like the expectation until 2021 at least, until we can actually see it, is that we're going to have 120 events a year between hockey and concerts, which does not leave room for basketball. If you were somebody who wanted to have...
It plausibly leaves room for basketball, but makes it more difficult.
But if you were somebody who wanted to have a soda arena for basketball almost exclusively, do you think that the city council, after seeing this, would maybe think that that was a more realistic option?
I don't know if it's going to change anyone's minds, but it is an argument for the Soto Arena group.
So this could be a good thing for basketball?
In the long run, possible.
Interesting. Okay.
Well, after all that, it's time for your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Did you see the double play the Mariners turned last week? Did you?
No, I didn't see it.
Even I managed to see it on Twitter. So in this game last week, at some point last weekend, the Angels had a runner on first base. I'm told his name is Brian Goodwin, which means we can now check the MLB player Kevin has never heard of, Big Guy Square. When Justin Bohr, and check that again, popped the ball up on the infield. Third baseman Ryan, don't call him Ryan, Healy, went to go catch the pop-up. Playing on the right side of the infield, or left side of whichever side it is, because of the shift. But second baseman D. Gordon told him to let it drop. Gordon then explained to Healy that he could throw to second base to force out the base runner, who had to stay close to first lest he get picked off. Then Gordon pointed to first base so that the Mariners can complete the double play by throwing out Bohr, who didn't run out the pop-up.
Oh, he didn't run out the pop-up.
And it wasn't the infield fly rule, because that
only
comes
in fly.
There's one runner on. There's two runners on. So people celebrated this as a fluke, unlikely play. But I see something more. I see a strategy. The M should start pursuing pitchers who can pop up hitters, then employ the D. Gordon strategy whenever there's a runner on first base. Sure, that might seem crazy, but they said that about the shift once upon a time, and look how popular that is now. The Mariners were literally employing it on that very play. If the Mariners could automatically get a double play every time they put a runner on first, they'd be even more unbeatable than they were the first 2 weeks of the season. And look, if it doesn't work, could it possibly be any worse than anything they've tried over the last 18 years?
Wow. So the real issue here... Wait, is that the end of the take?
Yeah, that was the end of the take.
The real issue here is that the runner didn't run.
That is. And then runners would just start running. So it actually is not a real
issue. Well, no, I heard about this. I was unfortunately having to listen to sports radio during a commute because my phone died. And they were talking about this play, and I hadn't seen it. I didn't really know the context of it. And they were talking about the infield fly rule, which I know quite well. But
you know, I used to own a copy of the baseball rulebook.
Of course you did.
At some point,
podcast baseball rules.
At some point, our mom, who is cleaning out my room in her house, will probably bring it to me and be like, do you want to keep this? It's in great condition.
And then stuff you didn't learn in Harvard Business School by Mark H. McCormack.
Yeah. And then it'll actually...
You'll be like, I've already read that 20 times.
It'll be like water stained and like the cover will be half torn off. She'll be like, it's great shape.
Of the baseball rule book.
This is only a joke that makes sense if you know our mom.
But so the runner didn't run, thus allowing them to execute this. I mean, it made sense for the Mariners to let the ball drop there, although...
Yes.
Couldn't the runner from first just have run then and gotten a second?
He could have, but it was kind of too late by that point.
I'm like, how much explaining here? Like, Dee Gordon explained to Ryan Healy, like, yeah, how much time does he have?
He, like, well, yeah, but, I mean, they had a lot of time because the hitter did not run at all. So he like literally pointed to second. Like, the hey, hitter's Ryan
like,
Healy.
He's, like, in the dugout with his helmet off. The bat is already up.
Hey, Ryan Healy, throw it there. And then they still didn't turn the double play. So he pointed to first base. And then they threw it to first base.
Wow. It took that long.
Well done, Dee Gordon.
This is really like, I mean, it's impressive by the Mariners, I suppose. This is really an Angels coaching issue, though.
No, it's really just impressive by Dee Gordon. Again, nobody else was involved.
The only Mariners thing that I thought about really this week, and they had a fun weekend.
They took 3 out of 4 against the Angels before losing both of the first two games of the Eddie Vedder Cup against the heated arch rival, interleague rival. San Diego Padres.
How dare they wear green on St. Patrick's Day in Peoria?
Well, before coming home to play the Rangers this weekend.
All right. But in the middle of sort of the celebration of the Dame 3 and the Blazers winning that series, I got a notification to my phone that the Mariners had lost a game. And I was like, this is the least that anybody has cared about a Mariners game. Somehow. It was just like, I was disorienting seeing it. It's like, what is happening? Every single tweet that was happening was all about Dame or the hockey game 7. And the Mariners somehow were playing baseball.
The Cubs are coming to town next week. And speaking of interleague play, so there are going to be a lot of Cubs fans at T-Mobile Park.
And maybe that's the Eddie Vedder Cup.
Yeah, also plausible. Let's move on to the Sounders, who had a rough week after their 5-0-1 start. On Sunday, they traveled to face LAFC in a nationally televised showdown and lost 4-1, playing without their two top forwards. Raul Ruiz is still out with a heel contusion, and Will Bruin newly sidelined by a hamstring strain, plus ace center back Chad Marshall due to knee inflammation, with Roman Torres making his first start of the season as part of the back line. They were really overwhelmed by the incredible LAFC attack, which got a pair of goals from leading MLS goal scorer Carlos Vela. The Sounders went behind early in 2-0 at halftime and then conceded shortly after, pulling one back through Harry Shipp shortly after the start of the second half en route to the 4-1 defeat. Marshall returned on Wednesday as the Sounders hosted the San Jose Earthquakes. Ruidiaz and Bruin remained out while manager Brian Schmetzer rotated the squad because of the busy week, giving the first starts of the season to Nuhu and Hanwala Buana. The Sounders went behind 2-0 on a pair of goals by Shea Salinas, but scored twice in a minute 30 stretch in the second half to equalize, settling for the 2-2 home draw against a lowly San Jose squad. Sounders dominated possession in this match, but didn't really necessarily create better chances than the Earthquakes had.
Yeah, and I think sort of this week sort of showed the Sounders are a good team, but they're not really a team that's going to necessarily compete for sort of the one seed or where they were at initially,
right,
with their unbeaten start through the first 6 matches.
Which they still were behind LAFC at that point.
Yeah, I mean, being behind LAFC at that point, and granted, it's a long season, right? Like, a lot can happen. This team could look so completely different by August than it does right now. It's nice to get out and have a little bit of a start here and score some points, but what they really look like is a team that is solidly in the playoffs, but not necessarily like a realistic challenger for the MLS Cup.
I mean, I think my big takeaway is the Sounders at full strength are really quite good.
It's a depth issue.
But you take out a couple of pieces and suddenly things fall apart quite quickly. Their depth is not very good. I think that's going to be, you know, the real focus for GM Garth Lagerwey during the summer transfer window.
And they'll pick up players. They'll add depth.
They will. Sounders now down to 3rd in the Western Conference standings in terms of points, but actually 4th in points per match behind both of the LA teams as well as the Houston Dynamo. They will get another chance against LAFC coming to town on Sunday in another nationally televised match at 12:30 on ESPN. The Sounders also announced on Tuesday that they'll face UEFA Champions League side Borussia Dortmund in a July 17th friendly at Central League. Midweek between two MLS matches, both of which are at home. Dortmund features USMNT star Christian Pulisic, as well as German national team star Marco Reus.
So, that's cool, though. This is the biggest international team they've played in a long time.
Yeah, in a few years here. They haven't had a notable friendly for a while. Reign FC drew again in their second match on over the weekend at home against the Orlando Pride in the first match at Cheney Stadium, 1-1, back on the road Saturday to face the Chicago Red Stars. Some sad news from the Seattle Storm on Friday is they announced that head coach Dan Hughes announced that he was diagnosed with cancer after an emergency appendectomy and will begin treatment for that. No word yet on how that treatment might affect his availability for Storm training camp. They'll begin training camp on Sunday, May 5th, so just a couple of a week and a half away at this point. You know, it goes without saying that our thoughts and prayers go out to Coach Hughes as he fights this. He's never been anything but great to work with, both in his time as a head coach elsewhere in the league and since he joined the Just Storm. So, you know, really hoping the best for Coach Hughes. All right, we start our UW section with football spring preview this Saturday at 12 noon. Are you still planning to try to go to this?
Sure.
That sounded very confident.
I didn't realize it was on Saturday. Of course I'm trying to go to this. What do you mean?
Okay.
Yeah.
I may or may not, depending on what the NBA playoff schedule ends up being for
Saturday. We'll see what the weather is like. If it happens to be September and I can get a Mahono chicken sandwich beforehand.
We might have to go to the Montlake Deli, Montlake Market. We've been told they have good sandwiches there.
I'm going
to
be at Mahono. I'm sorry.
You're just going to Mahono. you just ended the search. You're just going to Mahono.
If it's sunny, that's the rules.
UW softball took 2 of 3 last weekend at Utah. The loss on Sunday snapped a 16-game winning streak for the Huskies. Still third in the Pac-12 at 14-4, heading into a weekend off from conference play. They did play on Monday at Utah Valley, and Taryn Elvella threw the second no-hitter of her career.
Wow!
In the UW win.
All right.
We're skipping UW baseball because you declared it off the rundown.
Did anything happen?
I don't know. I didn't.
It's gone. They're off the rundown.
It's off the rundown.
It's just, you know what? UW baseball, work yourself back onto the rundown.
I don't know how they will do that. I wouldn't be aware of them working their way back on since I'm not checking them as part of the rundown.
But you'll know. You'll know it. You'll know if they're back on the rundown.
Maybe someone will send a tweet if they cannot. UW men's basketball guard Jalen Noel told Percy Allen, "I'm really all in at this point. About the draft process having entered. I never go into anything half-heartedly. That's just how I've been as a person. When I said I was going to enter the draft, that's what I meant, and that was final."
So, yeah, he's gone.
Closing the book. I mean, we expected this, but now it's like gone from 95% to 100% that he will not be part of the 2019-20.
Let's give it 99.9%.
Okay. You're leaving that one in 100 chance, or one in 1,000 chance. There was some Felton Cast math.
You're the one. You're the any chance rule guy.
It's true. Should we reflect? I mean, mostly we've talked so far about kind of Noel's draft stock and the reasons to not think it's that great. Should we reflect on his career at UW?
Yeah.
you have no reflection.
Jalen Noel's great.
I mean, I think the really...
We named a victory for him in his freshman year.
That is true. Like, that definitely happened. I mean, the really cool thing was, you know, Noel being the one guy from that recruiting class that was put together by Lorenzo Romar that stuck with the Huskies after the coaching change, committed to Mike Hopkins, and ended up being a huge part of Hopkins kind of establishing himself as UW's head coach.
Yeah, I mean, there were so many times... in this Husky offense in particular this season where they didn't really have a great true point guard.
Well, I think it was true last year too.
Over the last couple of years where they didn't have a great true point guard. You know, they didn't necessarily have sort of like a go-to player, and Jalen really had to fill that role. You know, when this team needed a bucket, Jalen was the player who was going to go out and get it a lot of those times. And I think he'll definitely be missed, especially when it's going to be a pretty young team next year. They'll be a very skilled young team, but they're going to be a very young team.
Yes. A troublingly young team, I would say.
And Jalen, I'll be curious to see how he fares in the NBA. Watching him, I don't think his game necessarily translates particularly well. But
apparently he needed to shoot more 40 footers off the dribble.
It's a bad shot.
Hmm. I mean, Pac-12 Player of the Year. I mean, yeah, Jalen Noel.
I like that you're just like out here to like to push the agenda of it actually being a bad shot. Like, I don't care. It went in, but it's a bad shot. I mean, that's what we could say to Jalen Noel. Every single like 18-footer that he took.
I mean, eventually you make enough of them, it stops being a bad shot, I guess.
Yeah, you're like, they're, oh my God. No, Jalen was able to get to the hoop, took way too many long jumpers, but still scored when it mattered, was not scared to kind of take control as a freshman when it mattered.
Yeah.
He's somebody who will definitely be missed on this team.
And yeah, we'll be remembered.
At the same time, I don't know if it's terrible to sort of clear out, because Jalen would have really dominated possession, and maybe some of the players who are coming in, Quadai Green's going to need the ball in his hands, and presumably potentially Jaden McDaniels, Isaiah Stewart, they're going to have to get the ball to those players, but
they're not going to be as effective with it as Jalen Noel would have been.
Yeah, I think Jalen will be severely missed.
Let's wrap up with the Seahawks heading into Thursday's NFL draft with the 21st and 29th picks. How many times will the Seahawks trade down in the first round at least?
I'm still a little chafed about that arena conversation. It's kind of way too heated. How much are you deleting of it?
We'll see.
I want it all gone. I feel like I got too honest.
Even if we delete it all, then people won't know what we're talking about here.
That's even better.
Okay.
Sometimes keeping it real goes wrong.
Seahawks, though. What's the over-under on number of trades down they make on Thursday?
1.5.
That's what I was going to say.
I mean, they're making a trade.
I'm taking the over.
I think the Seahawks will make a selection in the first round.
I also expect that they will make one selection in the first round.
I don't think they'll make two.
But I think it's possible you could go from, like, what, 21 to 25, and then from 25 to the second round or something like that. So I don't think those are incompatible statements.
Yeah. I think they will make a pick in the first round. I would be surprised if they made two, wherever they happen to fall. I would be surprised if at the end of the day they end up with less than 8 draft picks in this draft.
So starting out with 5 now after the trade? Yeah, it seems reasonable.
And they'll do some moving around later in the draft and shuffling of things and going and getting in players. But I think that they will have 8 players at the end of the day or more that they drafted this year.
What do you think? I mentioned this in the Frank Clark trade reaction pod, which I guess we haven't mentioned. You should listen to that. You should also listen to our draft preview with Zach Whitten if there's still time before the draft, even though the situation has changed a little bit, obviously, with the Clark trade. Still talking about probably the same group of prospects for the Seahawks.
Yeah, I mean, it really hasn't changed that much necessarily. Anyway, what were you going to ask?
So I posited that one possibility is now that they're looking at potentially 12 draft picks in 2020, that they could trade one of those 2020 picks to get into a different region of the 2019 draft. What do you think of the odds of that?
Unlikely. I think it's unlikely that we see, I could see maybe a pick swap in 2020, but I think it's unlikely that they just trade a pick in 2020 without getting a 2020 draft pick back.
I mean, 12 is a lot of draft picks to have.
We don't have them yet.
You're saying they're going to sign a lot of players that are going to offset those cap picks?
There's a lot of Ed Dixons out there.
I mean, they might sign a defensive end. That wouldn't be surprising.
There's still time for that to happen, and they can trade those picks later, and they can use those picks for flexibility. 12 is a good number for this team to have. I would be surprised if they just outright traded a 2020 pick.
I would not be surprised.
I think they will make one selection in the first round. I think they will make at least 2 selections in the second round, and probably multiple in the third and maybe fourth. So to me, the question is, let's say that they're drafting in the kind of mid to late 20s. Are there players positions or players that after kind of thinking about it more and Looking at the mock drafts are coming out, that Danny Kelly, an excellent mock draft from The Ringer and his top 100, has been doing great draft work there. Third Pelton brother, Danny Kelly.
Traitor Danny Kelly.
Third Pelton brother, traitor Danny Kelly.
Yes.
As he's known to you. Is there anything that stands out to you that you would like to see them do on Thursday in this first round of the draft?
I would probably be most excited to see them come away with a wide receiver and an edge rusher from their first two picks. But, you know, to some extent, I feel like unless it's, you know, like really off the board from the needs we talked about, I'm going to defer to the Seahawks in terms of what they see is how their needs match up with the value in the draft.
I agree with that to a certain extent.
Like if they take,
provided they're not drafting a running back, agree with that.
Yeah, that's why I said within that range. I mean, if they draft a safety, you know, if they decide that's a really big need, okay, sure. I mean, the safety core is not great. I get it.
I think I agree with that in as much as basically they know what their needs are more than we do. We know what their needs are. Publicly, we don't know how much they believe in from the tape and what they saw from Tedrick Thompson to really believe that he's a starting safety.
They may also have a better feel for how the draft board is going to play out. So, I mean, that's not saying that they're beyond criticism or reproach. It's just within kind of, you know, there's an acceptable group and whatever they want to do in there, feel free.
The things that I would say that I would draw criticism, obviously, drafting a running back in the first round again. No, if they drafted an offensive lineman.
Look, no, that would nobody would see that coming if they drafted another running back.
I would be very surprised if they drafted an offensive lineman, and I don't think that would be a good allocation of resources vis-a-vis the needs of the team. But listening to a couple of podcasts with Mel Kiper and ESPN's own Mel Kiper and Todd McShay, the way that they talk about the wide receiver class and where those players are going to fall, sort of in the 25 to 40 range, that there are a lot of potentially impact, early impact wide receivers in there. If the Seahawks ended up with three picks between 25 and 45 or something and took two wide receivers with those picks, I'd be pretty excited about it.
Three seems like that's a lot. I don't know if they're going to get that kind of haul, but okay.
Maybe a little bit later. But so if they were to forego a wide or an edge rusher in the first round and draft a wide receiver in the first round with the idea that they would, you know, an AJ Brown or somebody like that.
I was told by you that they have to draft a defensive end with their first, whatever this
is. No, I agreed with you. I agreed with you that they can draft a wide receiver in the first round.
Okay.
Or something else. Look, I mean, honestly, like if they drafted Byron Murphy in the first round, would I be upset about that? Absolutely not.
If they drafted Taylor Rapp in the first round.
If they drafted Kayla McGarry, Byron Murphy, Taylor Rapp, Greg Gaines, Jake Browning. Look, am I going to be upset about any of these?
Somehow they're going to draft Will Disley again. He's already on their roster. Right?
Miles Gaskin, Harry the Husky. Look, if they drafted any of these players, am I going to be upset? Jeremy Stevens.
No, I'm vetoing that back.
But it does feel like the places, because value is the most important thing in the draft, and it does feel like the position where you can really find value seems to be wide receiver near the end of the first round and early second round, and that's to me where I think the Seahawks maybe should be going on getting players.
It seems like a good marriage of value and need.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that they need a lot, there's good value at in the place that they have picks. It's like, it seems obvious that they should go out and do it. That means that they probably
will. Yeah, exactly. We've learned anything from Seahawks draft pass.
I hope you like Noah Fant.
I actually do like Noah Fant, for the record. But
no, I mean, like if he actually, I mean, Danny Kelly has him as the 32nd pick, the last pick of the first round. I think if Noah Fant falls that far and the Seahawks wanted a tight end, felt like they really needed a tight end, go ahead and take him.
Like they could always play two tight end sets with him and the throw.
Yeah. I'm into it. Or, are you waiting for it? Are you ready for it?
Three tight end sets?
All Fant tight end sets.
Oh, yeah, there we go.
Two Fant tight end sets.
Please stand for our national phantom.
But yeah, that to me is like after listening to Kiper and McShay talk about the draft, it's like we got to get some wide receivers in that range. Because there are good wide receivers out. There are wide receivers who, I mean, we watched N'Keal Harry. He's a good wide receiver.
Yes.
Who it seems like, for whatever reason, none of them have sort of elevated to first-round wide receivers. And they've all kind of been clumped together in that 25 to 45 range. But it feels like a lot of them, and really talking to Zach and hearing how he feels about a lot of these players, I think he feels very good about a lot of them.
Yeah.
So if they were to end up with a one or two of those types of players, plus sort of like a leader round edge rusher, like an LJ Collier edge rusher, right? Something like that. I'm feeling great about those first two rounds.
I agree with that.
So that's kind of just from hearing that I'm sold on that idea. And if they ended up with two, I'm feeling even better about it. Somebody like Jachai Polite, who I felt like was a super highly touted player early on, or if somebody falls,
right? You know,
if somebody falls, we just want the Seahawks to be the team that were kind of on it, and now they do have the flexibility to be the team that can go and grab, if Rashawn Gary or somebody like that falls, to go and grab them. They have the picks to do it.
They do.
So I'm looking forward to it.
We'll find out Thursday, or possibly not until Friday. You never know.
And maybe not until Saturday, and also maybe not until 2020.
On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.